The views and comments expressed on the Space Show by its guests, callers, and listeners belong to them. The Space Show and its hosts serve only as a platform and are not responsible for others' comments or views. All topics discussed on the Space Show are primarily for educational purposes.
We choose to go to the moon in this decade and do the other thing. Not because they are easy, but
we have main engine start. 4, 3, 2, 1.
It's the Space Show with Dr. David Livingston, broadcasting to 7 continents, consistently bringing you quality news and interviews with the best and brightest minds in the new space economy. Here is the founder and host of the Space Show, the man who best articulates the vision of space commercial enterprise, Dr. David Livingston.
And good afternoon, everybody. Welcome to the Sunday Space Show program. Great to be here. Thank you all for tuning in. Just a quick heads up, I'm headed to Long Beach tomorrow for the AIAA Space 2011 conference, so we will not resume live Space Show programming until Friday of the coming week. This is all in the newsletter, but I'll just give you that heads up. So if you would like to call us today and talk to our guest, Dr. Bob Richards, that phone number, 1-866-687-7223. You can also try our Skype line. You need to use a headset if you're going to use it, and we can hope it works. It's not always clear, but sure, give it a try if you want. And then also remember that if you want to email us, you can still use drspace@thespaceshow.com. And then we're trademarked and copyrighted, but we do allow you to download these shows and copy them and share them and pass them around. You get the MP3 format. Please don't edit the programs. Don't do anything commercial. And we don't permit written transcripts, even if they're for your own use. So please don't do them. This is one of the ways we protect our guests, because we don't want inaccurate transcripts and inaccurate quotes and things like that. If you have ideas for what you want to do with a transcript or with our shows, do run them by me, and if we can work it out, we'll certainly do that. But please do honor that for us and for our guest. And then remember that we're podcasting, and we thank Andrew over at gigadial.net for that service. You can find our RSS URL on our website, both of our newsletters, if you want to subscribe to the podcast, and you'll find us all over the place at iTunes, Microsoft, Zoom, and a host of other places as well. Do go to our website, thespaceshow.com. Our comprehensive newsletter is uploaded onto the website after our Sunday program. It has all of the details of the week's programs, the guest information, and it's the only place where we have a future events section. You can also sign up for the very short email newsletter, which goes out early Monday morning electronically. Very short, one or two lines about the week's programming. You'll see a store on our website. Do check it out. And then you'll see the Support the Space Show button. Remember, we're a 501c3 nonprofit with One Giant Leap Foundation. This program is only in existence because of your support and contributions, and we thank those of you who have supported us and those of you who will be supporting us. Remember, if you pay U.S. taxes, you do get a tax deduction. If you pay California taxes, you also are entitled to a California tax deduction as well. And then finally, remember that the Space Show is brought to you in part by the Secure World Foundation, promoting cooperative solutions for space security. And please do visit their website, secureworldfoundation.org, to find out more about what they're doing, the kinds of programs they're involved with. And we thank them for sponsoring our webinar programs. I'm very happy to bring back to the show our friend, Dr. Bob Richards, who is now the CEO of Moon Express, one of the Google Lunar XPRIZE entries. Bob is a space entrepreneur, a futurist. He is a co-founder of the International Space University, Singularity University, SEDS, the Space Generation Foundation, and he started up Odyssey Moon and now is the CEO, as I said, of the Moon Express. And while this is not in his official bio, I was at the V-Lab affair on Tuesday night at Stanford, and it just so happened that I sat next to my friends Dennis Wingo and his wife Nikki, and I had no idea that he was sitting in the group with the Moon Express crew, and that they all stood up at a certain time for acknowledgement. And talk about being impressed and blown away. I was caught off guard with that and very, very impressed, Bob. I didn't get a chance to tell you that, but sitting with that group or next to them was quite something. Listeners, his bio is up on the website many, many times over because Bob has been a guest with us. He was last on in December, and time to get some updates on how we're going to the moon. So welcome back, Bob, and what's been happening between December and September?
Hey, David. It's great to be back on the show. And a lot has been going on, and thanks for letting me know that you were there that night and were sitting amongst the gaggle of Moon Express staff that were there as a posse supporting the event. The reason I made them stand up is I just wanted everybody to see the youth involved in the new return to the moon. And although there was a little bit of a diversity in age, by and large, we have a majority of the 20-something, very equivalent to what the Apollo program was built on back in the 60s. It was 26-year-olds that took us to the moon back then, and it's going to be the same people that are going to take us back to the moon in this era.
You know,
Go ahead.
Well, I was going to say, you mentioned the 26-year-olds. This is totally unrelated to our show, but there's an opportunity where I may get a chance to go to New York to speak to a group of 14-year-old graduate boys in a prep school to give them an inspiring talk because they're interested in space. And, of course, they found me through the space show. So I'm waiting to see if that happens. But, you know, one of the points I was going to make is that we went to the moon with people with undergraduate and master's degrees and in their 20s. And that's not too far away from you guys who can take us to Mars or to a NEO or something really spectacular if you – you know, do the right studies and STEM education and things like that. But you're exactly right. 26-year-olds took us to the moon.
No, absolutely. And, you know, when you saw people stand up, there are some people in Moon Express, of course, who have known each other longer than most of the staff have been alive. So it's there is a depth of experience there as well, but trying to maintain kind of a 1-to-3 ratio where you have a couple of gray hairs around, people have been through the grind on space missions. Space is very, very hard, and you can't just be a garage mechanic and expect to have a space mission that works. But surrounding the company in very well-educated, motivated, and intelligent young people, you know, that's the thing I've always believed in. And if you look back at the history, I guess, of what I've been most motivated by, it's by building the organizations, institutions, and companies that will truly make us a multi-planet species. And having begun as a student back in the day and started SEDS and Space Generation and International Space University, it's truly living the dream these days of engaging the Space Mafia Network, as it was coined by Forbes back in the 90s, to work with these amazing people. And it's just incredible to get these young people together, give them a little bit of guidance, and then, you know, stand back and watch it happen.
How do you advertise or get people to work with you? Is it easy to do? Do you have to go and convince people that this is a real project and they're not just going to be spinning their wheels or wasting their time?
I'm fortunate that I don't have to do that, David. As you know, and I think many of the listeners may know if they read my bio, I've been building relationships and networks of people for decades now, of people who truly believe in instituting a new era of space flight. Those of us who are truly orphans of Apollo, you know, who lived the false dawn of hope, thinking that, you know, we would be graduating into these amazing programs and we would see 2001 in 2001. That never happened, and it was building the international networks over the last 30 years of ISU alumni and SEDS and all of these people out there. We're building this no matter what. And the fact that Moon Express exists, it is obviously a credible initiative. There's no shortage of amazing people coming to me and to us asking to be involved. So it's not a question of looking for the right people. It's a question of selecting the best and the brightest that will fit into the culture of the company, like SpaceX or any other company that needs to make sure that it's a great fit. And so there's no shortage of talent coming to the table, it's a question of the right balance of build the company, execute the technical program, and have a hell of a lot of fun while you're doing it.
So how many are on your team now?
Well, right now it's 23, I think, is the count. So still a small company by most counts. But we took on a pulse of young people in a recent media release. We announced that we'd acquired 9 incredibly talented young people through the NASA Ames Robotics Academy, who had been working together for years, inspired by FIRST Robotics. You know, all growing up through high school, became leaders of the FIRST Robotics competition, and then mentors of what became the 2011 world champion of the FIRST Robotics organization. If anybody knows that organization, that's no small feat. That's a worldwide global event, highly competitive. So we hired them all of the mentors, all of the lead team here at NASA Ames, and created something we call the Moon Express Robotics Lab for Innovation, or Merlin for short, where a lot of the magic of Moon Express is going to happen. And that added to the 14 that we already had. So we're at about 23. And if you added up everybody who touches Moon Express from a contract perspective, it's probably around 30.
Pretty amazing. So you're on a timeline because the prize money changes if nobody wins it by a certain deadline, correct?
That's right, David. The Google Interact Prize has a expiry date of the end of 2015. That was extended by a year when it became evident to XPRIZE and Google that the market, the XPRIZE was announced in 2007, and the worldwide financial markets took a bit of a downturn immediately following.
Really?
Not the best time to try to raise money for anything, let alone a moon mission. So given that and other considerations, the prize was extended a year to 2015, and there was formally a hardwired reduction in the grand prize money at the end of 2012 from $20 million to $15 million. That's since been removed, so there's no automatic step down anymore. So we do, as a company, we certainly wish to win the Google Interact Prize. However, it's not the cornerstone of the business. The business is not built around it, nor could you. GLXP is a wonderful catalyst which will inspire a new industry, I have no doubt. But as per the design of XPRIZES, it's not designed to cover the cost of doing the achievement. So the $20 million first prize is on the order of, depending on how you count the mission, about 25% of the money that will actually take to execute it. So the real trick is, where's the other 75% come from, and why would anybody spend that amount of money? We're talking $60 or $80 million on a mission to the moon. Why would anybody spend that? So the trick is to come up with a business plan that makes sense. So Moon Express is about building a sustainable company that is going to be profitable and is going to undertake ongoing robotic missions to the moon for exploration. While we're doing so, we'd like to win the Google Interact Prize, take that golden ring. But also, we have a contract with NASA worth up to $10 million called the Innovative Lunar Demonstration Data Program contract, which will allow us to sell data to NASA on a firm fixed price basis, where all the risk is on us, but should we provide the data that NASA is interested in, they will pay us on a milestone basis. So that's a very important aspect of what we're trying to do as well. But we'd like to try to do our first mission by the end of 2014.
By the end of 2014, a year ahead of the expiration of the
right,
thing.
Right. And if anybody is making a true goal of it, meaning it's not a stunt, it's not a one-time event, you're trying to build a business, then of course you have to have some backup, because as you and I know, David, space is hard and bad things happen. So you have to have a fault tolerance built into your plan. As we know, SpaceX, for instance, had a number of anomalies during their first attempts at launching, and space is hard. So you have to have that fault tolerance built in. So you wouldn't want to be trying for the Google Interact Prize, let's say, a month before it's expiring, because if something happens on the launch pad or in the transit to the moon, or more likely in the attempt for landing on the moon, you want to make sure you have a backup plan to try again.
Here's your first question. Is Alex is in Tucson, and he said, what rocket do you plan on using for your ride to the moon?
So that's, you know, that is kind of the main question. The rocket, per se, is the constitutes about half of the cost of the lunar mission, so it's a very important decision. We haven't announced the choice of any rocket. There are not that many contenders, of course. We've said that we want to stay, of course, with the commercial market. SpaceX is an obvious for us. We have a lot in common with SpaceX, including investors. The company we just applaud and just have nothing but the greatest admiration for. It's not the only choice that we would have, nor is launching from the United States the only choice any commercial lunar company would have. So there are alternatives. But that choice will be made and must be made by anybody competing for the Google Max Prize 24 months before they're attempting the mission, because that's how long it typically takes for a rocket purchase to take place. So in our plan, we will be announcing a decision of a rocket sometime next spring. And in anybody's plan, if they're trying to win the GLXP before the end of 2015, unless they're hoping for some last-minute piggyback, they would be having to announce a launch contract by 2013.
I from time to time, get people who complain about the lacking of a property rights regime as a stumbling block to space commerce. For you to have sustaining, ongoing robotic missions on a commercial basis to the moon, is the lacking of any kind of a real property rights regime a hindrance to you guys at all?
No, it's not a barrier. It's a necessity in the long term, I believe, to assert property rights outside of the Earth. But it's not necessary for the first exploration mission to take place, nor is it necessary for economics to take place. And we talked about this a little bit before, I think, David, in prior programs, but the analogy would be international fishing. You don't have to own the ocean or the fish to have the right to send a boat into the waters of the fish. And when you bring the fish onto the deck, then they're your fish. So the same thing happens in space. You don't have to have title to the land. The international treaties allow for peaceful uses of outer space and extraterrestrial bodies for exploration. It allows for exclusion zones or zones of non-interference for governments or private sector entities to land on another body like the moon and to conduct exploration and scientific experiments and have the right to do so without interference. So if you also have the right and the precedence of there in the 60s to bring stuff back to Earth that you own. So if you're interested in bringing back a moon rock and selling it on eBay, all of the infrastructure is currently in place that allows you to get a launch license to go to the moon, to peacefully operate that installation or the robotic exercise to be out of the moon without interference, to get the rock. Now you're a rock. You bring it back to Earth. It remains your rock, and you have the right to sell it or do whatever you want with it. And that precedent is there and has been asserted a number of times over by both the U.S. and the Soviet governments. So there's nothing that stands in the way of economics to take place, of, say, mining the moon or bringing back valuable materials. Eventually, this will lead to precedents and interest relationships, which will allow, I believe, which will allow the very important question of private ownership to take place. But it's not a barrier to answer your question.
Are you the only Silicon Valley team?
Team being in the Google and XPRIZE? No, there's actually another one, Team Phoenicia, that's been around for a while now. Will Barrett is, I think, known by a number of people in the space community. So they have a different approach, and they're developing some interesting technologies. And so it's not the only Moon Express is not the only Silicon Valley based team, but I would say that we're probably the only one that is currently financed to move forward with the mission.
And this is another question, Paul, in Albuquerque, along the same lines. There are lots of teams. I would imagine some are more competitive to others than others. Do you feel the heat of competition from any specific team or teams, and would you mention which ones they are?
So it's an interesting question, but let me make sure that the premise isn't misunderstood. Competition is a necessity. I applaud, welcome, and need serious competitors in this industry. We all do. If anybody was trying to stand up a commercial lunar company and you were the only one, it wouldn't look very good. It would look like, what do you know that other people don't know? The fact that there is competition is fantastic. And if that competition becomes hot or heated, it's even better. And Silicon Valley and entrepreneurial companies thrive on competition, and LunExpress certainly does as well. The United States government through NASA conducted an assessment of commercial companies, not limited to Google Lunar XPRIZE contenders, that may be capable of delivering data in the execution of their lunar missions. And NASA selected 6 U.S. companies back in the fall, and those are listed online. LunExpress was, of course, one of those. And of the 6, NASA further down selected 3 to receive the first data contracts back in October, November, and those 3 were Astrobotic out of Carnegie Mellon, Rocket City Space Pioneers, based in Huntsville, and LunExpress. And all 3 companies successfully completed their first milestone contract element under the ILDD program within the last couple of months. So that was a very good thing to have happen. So the competition, I would say, has heated up a lot, and it's a very good thing.
So here's another interesting, at least it's interesting to me. This is from Helen in Las Vegas. And Helen says, I'm wondering if you could outline the development process that you go through. Not only do you have to have what it is you're going to put on the rocket, but you need to have a lander, you need to have a landing process, you need to have the rover, the communications. Do you divide your team up so that simultaneously you're working on all of the components at the same time, or are you prioritizing and first you're doing this component and when you have this one ready or near ready, you switch to the next in line? What is the engineering or the manufacturing process for doing something like this?
It's an excellent question, highly complex in the way that it's been framed. So let me see if I can kind of carve it up a little bit to see if I can present the answers that make most sense. Because some of the answers depend not on what you should do, but what your strategy as a business. So there's no right answer in many of the in many of the answers to that question. Now, first of all, LunExpress is about the last mile to the moon. We're not about building rockets. We're not about building any infrastructure that can be purchased by other companies doing it very well. You can buy everything you need to get to the moon commercially. You can buy the rocket, you can buy the interstage, you can buy star trackers, you can rent the USN network for communications. What you can't buy is what slows you down and gets you down to the surface, the lander. So the lander system is the thing that doesn't exist anywhere. Whether you can't get it through the government, you can't get it through the private sector. The last landers on the moon were in the 70s. Of course, you have the Apollo human-rated landers, but you have many robotic landers going to the United States and the Soviet Union. But that's 4 decades ago. So the people and the technologies are museums. There are no production lines in place. The reason that governments and many of them are now going around the moon with probes in orbit is because they don't have landers to get down the surface. So the Google Lunar XPRIZE, I've said for a long time, you know, it's not a race the race is all about building the landing system that can slow you down. That's what has to happen. So Moon Express has been concentrating, and the reason that we have established a partnership with NASA is that there was an invention that NASA created several years ago of a common spacecraft bus centered here at NASA Ames that was very unique. It was created not in a traditional NASA sense of the program, but in a very small Skunk Works Tiger Team type format, which is very entrepreneurial and very innovative. And that technology is a very flexible and innovative technology that creates the core of the spacecraft that has since been developed into another orbiter program in NASA called LADEE. And NASA, that LADEE is a funded program of NASA's, and NASA Ames will be leading that. That will be the next orbiter to launch to the moon in about 2014. This common spacecraft bus is at the core of that LADEE mission. Moon Express entered into a reimbursable Space Act agreement with NASA that allowed us to commercialize the core of that technology, the common spacecraft bus, and develop a lander version of that same technology. So as we concentrate on developing technology, we're not inventing everything from the very beginning. We're only inventing stuff that really doesn't exist. So we will be buying the rocket commercially. We'll be buying the interstage commercially. We are developing the landing system and all the subsystems that are necessary to get down to the surface that don't exist. All of the avionics and all of the software and the landing gear and the radar. There's a lot that has to go into it. And as we execute those programs, yes, they are going in parallel. Like any space mission, you have to have divisions of the company with core competencies that can either develop the technology that you've chosen to invest in because you say you want the IP or it just doesn't exist, and or those that you want to procure externally, but you need to have core expertise within the company to be able to have the intelligent conversations with the suppliers and to be able to manage those programs for schedule and cost effectiveness. So that's probably a longer answer than was anticipated, but it's a very good question, and it's not an easy pat answer to produce.
Larry has another question. Listeners, you know, remember we're pushing for the phone lines and to stop using email as much. So it is 1-866-687-7223. Larry says, on the assumption that Moon Express does not win, do you still plan to do sustainable commercial missions to the moon?
Absolutely, yes. So, again, the Google Next Prize, I'm proud to be participating. It's a wonderful catalyst. It's drawing more credibility and attention to moon exploration than any other program has in decades. So hats off to the X Prize Foundation and all that's going on there. But Moon Express was not formed around winning the prize. I've been thinking about commercial lunar missions since I reached Mars with the Phoenix Mars Lander program back in 2007. And the GLXP, the Google Next Prize, is a very important aspect and credibility factor. With Google backing it is an incredible credibility for interest in the moon. But Moon Express is not built on the necessity of pursuing or winning that prize. The riches that promise us, we explorers who go to the moon with an entrepreneurial perspective for the first time, are so magnificent and so extensive that they justify, once pointed out, once exploited, and once brought back with an economic dipole with nurturing benefits to Earth, we are exploring a new world, and the benefits of opening up that world are largely unpredictable. And Moon Express has informed based on the belief of the true economic potential of the moon to benefit all of us here on Earth and to be a necessary platform for future exploration of the moon, of Mars, and for helping humanity become a multi-planet species.
We're going to take our break in a minute, but first this question. You know, I know you said earlier that the launch costs were around half of your cost, But if you ask the question, if are the launch costs so high that they skew the access to space and all of what you're doing, and to be commercial, you need to have, you know, radically lower launch costs, which is what we hear all the time. We got to have cheap access to space. Is that true, or can you really have a winning commercial model with the costs that we have today?
David, the answer is yes, but the economic model has to be large enough to justify it. It's, you know, when you have any business plan that half of it is vested into one particular technology within the mission, that's a problem. If you're looking at it from a mission perspective or even a few missions, it's extremely challenging, and that's why everybody's having such a tough time getting off the planet. Thank gosh you have SpaceX and others trying to bring that launch cost down. But when you look at the economic benefit of the moon in the long term, and it justifies not only investing in more frequent launches, which will bring the launch cost down, but in the additional infrastructure you need between the Earth and the moon to bring materials back and for creating fuel systems on the moon that justify the exploration to begin with.
Once you get up and running, ideally, how many flights could you make to the moon per year?
So that's really so unpredictable right now, based on, you know, there's a risk benefit curve that our investors have, and the money is available to conduct as many missions as we would want, based on the economic value being returned. Right now, we can count on, you know, in the first few years, one a year, I think, would be a nice pace of missions to the moon. My gosh, you know, we haven't been to the moon surface in 40 years. I wanted to start 20 years ago. So let's just start with one a year for now. And the first thing we have to do is find out where we want to go and what we want to do there. And based on the economic opportunities and the markets that will arise once we do so, then we can pick up the pace as much as we want.
Okay, let's take our first pause for our first break. And listeners, we will be back in about 3 minutes. And again, the number, if you would like to call us, 1-866-687-7223. Back in 3 minutes.
The Space Show thanks its listeners for their generous support. The Space Show now joins forces with the One Giant Leap Foundation to further advance space education and the establishment of a spacefaring society and culture in America and the world. One Giant Leap Foundation is a tax-exempt organization with the purpose of advancing space education and development along with the Space Show. Your support of the Space Show and One Giant Leap Foundation helps get the word out as to why space is so essential and important to us all. So join with us by going to www.thespaceshow.com and clicking on the Support the Space Show button. Your contribution will help the Space Show and One Giant Leap Foundation in continuing its work and bringing you the programming you want free of charge on a continued basis. And remember, your gift to the Space Show is tax deductible.
The mission of the Space Show is to promote future economic opportunities, scientific discoveries, and medical advances for all humankind through peaceful and cooperative ventures in outer space. The Space Show intends to be the forum by which space exploration becomes an integral part of our culture, our economy, our country, our world, and our global vision, in which all nations unite in creating a thriving future through the enormous potentials afforded by off-Earth opportunities. The Space Show is committed to advancing integrity and responsibility, both in our off-Earth conduct and in the potential long-range consequences of our actions in space. The Space Show wants to make the dreams of space today the realities of tomorrow.
And welcome back, everybody. This is our Sunday Space Show. We're talking Moon Express with the CEO, Dr. Bob Richards. And our first caller is with us, Marshall from Dallas. Hi, Marshall. How are you today?
Just fine. How are you?
I'm fine. You have a question or a comment or something for Bob today?
You're talking about landing on the moon and being from the Dallas area. I'm rather familiar with Armadillo Aerospace and John Carmack, and they did the Northrop Grumman Lunar Lander Challenge level two, and they completed the challenge, and they have a lunar lander quality type system. Are you looking at a similar type system for your lander? And B, if I recall, it weighed in at about 1,000 pounds. And are you significantly going to cut that weight?
So, David, I caught the first part of that question about John Carmack and Armadillo. I kind of lost the last part.
He's basically saying they have a lunar lander through the Lunar Lander Challenge number 2. It weighs around 1,000 pounds. Are you doing something similar or using it, and are you able to reduce that level of mass?
Oh, okay, so I didn't get that last part. So first of all, Armadillo, amazing company. John Carmack, I know John, and I have great respect for their approach. Small team, build and test. And that's they've done amazing things throughout the years, and of course they were the favored to win the Northrop Grumman Lunar Lander Challenge, and I know that's a mouthful, and with surprising everybody, lost out in the last furlough of the race to NASA and Space Systems, who took the grand prize of $1 million. So Armadillo and NASA, those systems were developed, despite the name, really to be vertical takeoff and landing test platforms. And they, John Carmack and Armadillo, you'll note, did not enter the Google InterX Prize, nor did Mastiff. And it might seem odd that they would not be competitors, but there really isn't a direct link between the two, because the requirements of the Northrop Grumman Challenge were different. They satisfied the desire of those companies to develop the vertical takeoff and landing capabilities and to advance their technologies. Both companies have different business cases. Armadillo is vested and interested in personal spaceflight and suborbital, and that technology that was developed during that competition is being carried forward in that realm, and they're not developing systems that would be compatible with the lander systems you would need for a lunar mission. Mathen is the same thing. They're developing very interesting avionics and engine capabilities. As a matter of fact, the former lead of the guidance, navigation, and control team for Mathen is now working for Moon Express. So with a great hats off to what they're doing, those lander systems that you see are not the type of lander systems you would need or use for a lunar lander system that's actually going to the moon.
Are you going to be able to get well under that 1,000 pounds, though? The cost of getting it into just low Earth orbit is very dependent on the payload. And, you know, the minimum payload to the lander, that's the real fun, I think.
Well, I think, again, we're speaking across purposes here, that the Armadillo system you see flying in the sky, doing great feats and advancements, is being developed towards suborbital flight, not as a lunar system. So you wouldn't be doing what that is doing if you're developing a lunar system. We have a lunar lander prototype system that is here at our facility in partnership with NASA Ames, that is hovering as well, but we're developing the avionics and control, and our systems, as we have said publicly, are based on a hybrid of DOD propulsion systems that were developed for the 1980s in the interceptor mode of the Star Wars program, these very, very small, agile engines, for the first time being available commercially, enables a disruptive type of technology to be introduced to a lunar landing system, and that is the baseline for our company's lunar lander.
I also was looking at Smart One, which is a European satellite that did an orbital, and as I recall, it was about $150 million, and it had a payload of only 19 pounds, as such, no, 19 kilograms. And the cost to the weight and everything was, you know, is very high. And I also remember that they piggybacked Smart One on an Ariane 5 launch for a different satellite. Is there a...
Well, again, we're talking... don't mean to interrupt, but we are talking apples and oranges again. Smart One, first of all, was a technology demonstrator that used ion propulsion. It was an orbiter, had nothing to do with landing. Smart One did impact the moon at the conclusion of its mission. It was not a landing system, and it was a technology demonstrator for ion propulsion. It was not designed to take payload to the moon at all. It was the science part of it was an add-on. It was a technology demonstrator, and so it wasn't optimized for payload delivery whatsoever. With our system, with our landing system, we have a and the images of it and data about it are available publicly online, is on the order of about 150 kilograms total landed mass, delivering about 50 kilograms of payload to the surface of the moon. An extremely high payload to total mass ratio that is achievable through the use of these very high energy to mass thrusters that were developed during the DoD programs in the United States back in the 80s.
Well, the direction I was actually going to is, can it be piggybacked or put into space at the same time as another satellite on something heavy lift like the Delta IV?
I guess the answer is yes. You can send anything to space piggyback. The question is not can you, the question is should you, or does it fit in with your strategic plan? So it impacts such things as does your plan need for you to have control over your own destiny as far as when you launch and what you launch with? Being a secondary payload has a lot of drawbacks, and not the least of which is you're not in charge of your own destiny, and you can be kind of dismissed from the mission at any time, but at prime. So that's not really in our interest, although other Google and XPRIZE competitors may well consider a piggyback scenario.
Mm-hmm. Okay, that's enough fun for me for today. So
thank you, Marshall.
Yeah, bye-bye.
Bye-bye. So, listeners, if you want to call, that line is available, 866-687-7223. And in a way, Marshall's call is really important, Bob, because there in the space enthusiast community and a large segment of even the space show audience, there is lots of confusion as to the role a specific mission plays in how you design, launch, and handle the mission. So to confuse a lander going to the moon with a payload with an orbiting satellite, those are really different missions with all sorts of different ingredients in them to make those missions work. And they really are apples and oranges big time. So, you know,
I think maybe not an unfair comparison would be the difference between suborbital and orbital on Earth is about the magnitude of complexity more you need from an orbiter to a lander mission to the moon. It's an order of magnitude more complex than sending an orbiter, and you have to take a lot more fuel with you because you have to you have to impact the moon, but you have to do so at zero velocity. And that takes a lot of fuel, and it takes a lot of very smart software and sensors.
And then if you're going to bring something back, that's another layer of complexity into such a mission. And
I would say it's, again, an order of magnitude more complex of bringing a sample back from the moon than landing on the moon. Two orders more complex than an orbiter mission.
So, you know, listeners, I urge you to sort of keep separate in your mind suborbital, orbital, and, you know, a lunar orbital mission or any kind of orbital mission or a mission to the space station or anything like that from trying to do a usable soft landing with something that is going to work once it gets down on the moon. I mean, they're just not the same kind of mission. The hardware is different. The planning is different. The needs are different. And I just don't think they're fair comparisons. And but that is a common misunderstanding across the platforms in a lot of people's minds. They you know, well, if you're orbiting the moon, you might as well be able to land there, right? So
right. Well, right. Well, a more relevant comparisons actually exist more recently, David, on Mars. Even though it's an air world or an atmosphere world, not an airless world like the moon. Nonetheless, it was these were systems. The Phoenix Mars mission that I was on in 2007 was the first propulsive landing on another planetary body since the 1970s and the 90s. Right?
Right.
It's very, very difficult to land propulsively on any other surface. The MER rovers, the Mars Exploration Rovers, which continue to be just dramatic examples of engineering ingenuity, as they continue to work 6 or 7 years later, they didn't land with propulsive means. They landed with balloons and bounced across the surface for a long time. But still a very, very complex landing. And the Mars Science Lab, which is going to be going to Mars, has another propulsive descent mechanism that is even more complex. So looking at the missions landing on Mars are probably more relevant of recent history.
Do you know where you're going to want to land on the moon, and what do you use for your information? Do you use LRO pictures or other things, or what's your source of data?
We haven't announced. We have a very good idea of where we want to go on the moon, where we want to land on the moon. We haven't announced that yet, David. We're going to keep that secret for a little while. But absolutely, yes, the Lunar Reconnaissance Orbiter, LRO, which is the U.S. spacecraft up there right now, delivering more data about the moon than all of the probes in history to date, an amazing, amazing successful mission, will definitely inform our mission and the data sets that are coming back from LRO, not just for us, but for everybody going back to the moon are extremely helpful.
So all of that is public domain. You can access it then.
Right. And if I could give a little plug to you mentioned Dennis Lingo that you're sitting beside during the D-Lab event. As you probably know, David, Dennis and Keith Cowling run a project called the Lunar Orbiter Image Recovery Project, again, based here at NASA Ames, at a place lovely called McMoon's because it's a converted McDonald's, are doing an amazing job at extracting images from the original lunar orbiter tapes that were developed back in the 60s as reconnaissance prior to the Apollo program. And this imagery is in many ways as good and in some ways better than LRO can even achieve with our modern technology and 4 or 5 decades later. So we also have the advantage of that database as well.
Yeah, I've been down to where Dennis works, and I've seen him working and seen some of the imaging that they process. It's unbelievable.
It is unbelievable.
Unbelievable. And what's more unbelievable is it sat in film cans for, 3-4 decades before this project got underway with Dennis and Keith to resurrect and bring this imagery back.
Right.
I mean,
right. And the data for some time was classified because it was of a higher resolution than was ever admitted by the U.S. for obvious security reasons back in the 60s and 70s. So it's incredible that the film, you know, the analog tapes are still there and the that the data is still there. And it's just been an amazing, you know, techno-archaeology for Dennis and Keith and all the people supporting them has been able to resurrect and extract that data that has been sitting there for so long.
Barbara in San Diego sent in an email and says, do any of the Google Lunar XPRIZE teams have to dance around national security issues to do your lunar mission?
Well, I think the answer is it's a very serious question, and I think the dancing is kind of metaphorical. So there's no dancing around something called ITAR. And it's David, you and I have had this discussion a number of times.
Yeah, haven't we all? Yeah.
Right. So let me answer first of all by, you know, there are 26, I believe is the number, Google Interact Prize teams currently competing. Less than half of those are from the United States. So there are a lot of international contenders, and each country has their own rules about export control, and every country concerns itself about its own, you know, security and the technology and anything that it develops being getting into the wrong hands or being used subversively as weapons or so forth against it. Nowhere on the planet is that concern, understandably, more prevalent than in the United States, where the export control around armament is extreme for obvious reasons. The unfortunate consequence of a very broad application of the international trade and arms regulations laws in the United States are that anything that travels in space is considered an armament and is therefore subject to the same rules as a weapon of with destructive intent. So there, when you're a U.S. company or a U.S. citizen working on a space mission, you have to be completely cognizant of those rules and play by them. If you are a non-U.S. entity doing business with a U.S. entity, there have to be State Department approvals in place for those entities to do business. So you can't dance around anything. You have to meet these things head on and deal with them. And it's not that you can't deal with them. You just have to be aware and go through the proper process and paperwork and have the right checks and balances in place. I hope that's a reasonable answer.
Here's another question, and this is from Linda, and she's in Marina Del Rey. And Linda says, I'm an old-timer, so I remember the Apollo missions to the moon. When the hardware was left on the moon, nobody thought anything about it. I'm wondering, since you're not bringing your hardware back and you're leaving it on the moon, all of the teams that make it to the moon, are there any issues that you are facing today in terms of putting debris on the surface of the moon? Are there any organizations or are there any groups that oppose or offer suggestions for not doing that?
It's a very interesting point. And, you know, one person's garbage is another person's treasure. So, for instance, I am sure that this person would not consider Apollo 11 or Apollo 17 or indeed any of the Apollo sites as debris left on the moon. These are sites of historic significance, where symbolizes human achievement in an era that will never be repeated again. I believe that the first private landing on the moon will be a place of similar significant importance, and future moon travelers and moon visitors will want to go see the place where, for the very first time in human history, a private sector company, just people like you and me, managed to mount a mission to the moon and land there and start a whole new economic race in space. So that will be hallowed ground historically. Now, not every scrap of metal on the moon is hallowed ground, so there is what I would consider debris on the moon as a consequence of doing missions. For instance, every time an Apollo mission landed on the moon, and you know there were six of them between 1969 and 1972, some of the rocket stages that they had used to boost them to the moon ultimately impacted the moon themselves. So there's a lot of stuff that's impacted the moon, just the consequence of sending stuff there. Everything that's been left behind the moon, I would, consider of scientific and technical and historic importance. Now, there's also a concern that we don't have completely chaotic activity on the moon that would inadvertently compromise, let's say, something of scientific value on the moon or exploration value. You don't want to contaminate areas of the moon that you're trying to do scientific research in. So there is a level of responsibility leveled on the shoulders of everyone that will be doing lunar activities, whether it's governments or commercial players, to play nice, to respect others, and to not contaminate a world inappropriately, where certain cautions can take place that would prevent compromising either scientific or exploration value of a certain area. The of interest, NASA, in this area has recently come out with some guidelines, and these guidelines are a living document currently under development. For instance, of any spacefaring entity that would wish to visit an Apollo site, NASA is believing that this is a very real possibility, including the Lunar X Prize over the next few years. And they're issuing guidelines because there's no precedent to say, you know, what you can and can't do on the moon. So they're issuing guidelines of the way that they would like others to behave around their site. And that's very helpful information for those of us who want to respect other people's property and not mess with anything they don't want us to touch. And also respect the scientific integrity of certain areas of the moon, but also not to the point that we're not moving forward economically and helping develop resources that can benefit everybody on Earth. So it's a careful balance.
How far, assuming your mission works or one of the other teams work, how far are we from being able to do retrieval missions and bring things back from the moon? Is that a natural evolution in your technology?
So it's a good question. So there's nothing technically that's preventing us from doing a sample return from the moon. As a matter of fact, the Soviet Union did it in the 1960s and 70s. So there have been sample returns to the moon. We've had sample return missions from deep space. There's nothing tactically that it's complex for sure. It's a very complex mission involving rendezvous and docking technologies of payload spacecraft and return spacecraft. And these don't have to be big things, by the way. These can be very small spacecraft, but they're very complex. But nothing technically that prevents you from doing it. What the challenge is building the core competency and the capacity to do it as a commercial company. And doing so in a way that makes economic sense. So there would be nothing stopping us from trying to execute a sample return mission on our very first mission. It would probably be advisable to get a couple of one or two missions under your belt, landing on the moon, which is hard enough. My friend and our chief scientist, Alan Stern, who's the principal investigator of the New Horizons mission on its way to Pluto right now, and a veteran space mission scientist and a former associate administrator for science for NASA, told me, you know, when I started thinking about these missions at the very beginning, he said, Bob, you know, look for one miracle, you know, not five. You know? So I think it's just prudent to look for a single miracle to happen, which would be a successful private landing on the moon. But quickly thereafter, we will be able to develop the techniques and the technologies for bringing stuff back.
We're going to pause here, and we'll take our next break and come back with our final segment. Listeners, back in 3 minutes. And again, your phone line is available to you, 1-866-687-7223. Back in 3 minutes.
The Space Show thanks its listeners for their generous support. The Space Show now joins forces with the One Giant Leap Foundation to further advance space education and the establishment of a spacefaring society and culture in America and the world. One Giant Leap Foundation is a tax-exempt organization with the purpose of advancing space education and development along with The Space Show. Your support of The Space Show and One Giant Leap Foundation helps get the word out as to why space is so essential and important to us all. So join with us by going to www.thespaceshow.com and clicking on the Support The Space Show button. Your contribution will help The Space Show and One Giant Leap Foundation in continuing its work and bringing you the programming you want free of charge on a continued basis. And remember, your gift to The Space Show is tax deductible.
I'm Dr. David Livingston, creator and host of The Space Show, and I would like to share my vision with you for not only this radio program, but for space development. Space should be like any other place we choose to visit, work in, or call our home. It should be just another destination, like Tahiti, Hawaii, or any place available to us right now on Earth. When this vision becomes reality, we will be spacefaring in our culture, our economy, our society, and in our lives. Our world will be vastly improved by countless space-related benefits, transforming our lives both in space and right here on Earth. And the Space Show is helping to make this vision a global reality. And welcome back, everybody. You're listening to the third and final segment of our Sunday Space Show program. We're talking Going to the Moon with Bob Richards and Moon Express, a Google Lunar XPRIZE contestant. You can call us 1-866-687-7223. All questions are fine, including business and finance questions. Bob is a business and finance guy. Bob, during the break, you reminded me of the last question you got at the V-Lab meetings at Stanford Tuesday evening, and I said it's a good way to lead off this segment. But basically, the question you got was, how important is what happens with NASA over the coming months and years to your plans and Moon Express and Google Lunar X Prize, you know, because we know the budgets are under stress and Congress is this way or that way, depending on, you know, when the solstice occurs or something else, who knows. How dependent or reliant are you on NASA?
Well, thanks for that, David. It's we are not dependent or reliant on NASA. However, it's extremely important that NASA weighs in of the importance of commercial space. So the political situation, you know, a huge opportunity always happens at the boundary condition of a phase change that's about to take place in any one industry. We're in a phase change right now with space exploration, under, of course, endless debate right now and the fight between Congress and NASA and political interests throughout the United States. But it's at this time that, and in the past year, that NASA has explicitly, and the White House policy has explicitly demonstrated and talked about the importance of the private sector and a new way of doing business in space. And if it wasn't, it was that culture, that change in the tide that helped bring in the Silicon Valley investors that backed Moon Express. They saw a new era being manifest. And so although you would never, at least you should never, build any business based on NASA or any NASA or any government entity, governments, as you know, are not just fickle, but, I mean, they're subject to political whims, and your customer can go away at any time. So you don't build your business case based on NASA, but it was very important for NASA to weigh in on commercial lunar activity by creating this innovative lunar demonstration data program. It's an extension of the approach to fixed price milestone-based contracts that are being utilized for the commercial crew and cargo contracts that companies like SpaceX have. It allows the private sector to embrace all of the risk. So the risk is not on the taxpayer. It's in the private sector where it should be. And it guarantees that the taxpayer sees the value from the private sector in that the fixed price and the value of the achievement or the activity or the data is established up front. So it was NASA weighing in, which complemented the existence of the Google Lunar X Prize, which is a $30 million purse coming from Google. And NASA added another $30 million budget that would be available to private sector teams that it would select to buy data from as they executed their lunar programs. So that's a double-sided coin of the government. Very, very essential that NASA is a part of it. Investors want to see that the nation's space agency has a considers our company and those others under the IODD program as important and also capable. So a little bit of a capability vetting by an expert agency. Nor do you want to have NASA or any government agency as a cornerstone upon which your business is built.
Do you consider this support and direction of commercial space to be a political risk, and it could change with a different election result or a different budget? I mean, you know, is this now entrenched, or is it risky?
Yeah, that's always possible, David. But I believe that if the United States, which is lacking direction in space right now, finds its way and finds strong leadership and somebody willing to declare that this is the destination of the United States, whatever that might be, and it might be the moon again. That destination was dismantled by the Obama administration to the distress of many. But, you know, when you get into business, it's like the bar business. The bar business is good because when things are bad, business is good. And when things are good, business is good. So that's the type of business you want to be in. And commercial lunar could be argued to be the same type of business. That if United States or another country decides that it's really seriously going to the moon, then there's going to be huge opportunity in it for the private sector to deliver services, early transportation systems, sensors and data, huge opportunity. If, as is the current situation, the United States and other countries are not there yet, then there's an opportunity for early adopters and those entrepreneurs who get there first to set up the railways that will allow economics to start to take place. And then you're in the build it and they will come mode, which is more risky, but in the area of space has historically shown, especially commercial space has historically shown that you build it and they will come. And that's been shown over and over again.
Do you think that if you are able to get there, do this, and one or two others, maybe they don't win the Google Lunar X Prize, but they also get there, and let's say between 2014 and 2016, you have two or three commercial enterprises with some sort of establishment on the lunar surface, can you even imagine what that does and how that transposes the whole space economic model? I'm thinking that would be such a monumental change that it would be hard to even imagine what it would look like.
Well, either of those cases, David, what we're doing is that, you know, like the Ansari X Prize, change people's perceptions of what is possible. And that's why the X Prize exists. Right? It's just like Charles Lindbergh. When he changed the minds of people towards personal spaceflight, the entire aviation industry changed. When the first private sector companies reached the moon, whether they're winning the Google Lunar X Prize or whether they're there for other purposes or after the X Prize, that's going to completely change people's notions of what is possible. And we're after a whole new world here. And you know, the play here is as large or larger than the question of what was the economic value of opening up the Americas to Europe and Pan-Asia. It's something that you just can't predict because it's so beyond the realm of comprehension. You're opening up a new continent, which is largely unexplored, which recently we found has compelling evidence of valuable and precious metals and platinum group metals and volatiles and is not the dry, dead world that we were told back in the 70s when the United States decided to abandon the moon more quickly than it had achieved it. When we do this, we'll be opening up a whole new sister world for humanity, and it will play into the economics of planet Earth in ways that we can't comprehend or foretell. Particularly, trillionaires will be made in space, and those entrepreneurs that are able to discover and exploit and bring back, will be the business plan that will lead to the first trillionaire.
You have this email from Henry in New York, and listeners, there's still time if you want to call us, 1-866-687-7223. Henry says, I have an investor question for you, Bob. There's a lot of talk about investors take on risky investments. They want higher rates of return and other kinds of things that slant the risk-reward ratio in their favor for taking on such a risky investment. However, in the space world, with so much uncertainty, including political risk, including timing, what does a typical space investor look for? Is it for a return on investor, a return on investment? Is it for an exit strategy in 5 or 6 years max? Can you give us a profile of a space investor?
I think that's an excellent question, and I think there's three dimensions to that question that are important to touch on. One is that it's absolutely true that standard investment ratios would discredit or compromise any conceivable space business plan you might want to put in front of them. I tried for some time to raise money in markets in London and Wall Street, and you know, it just didn't happen. And I had a 150-page, well-written business plan that was fully modeled, that is kind of your walking paper for VC type of funding. It doesn't fit those models. If you just glance at who is investing in space, you'll find they're not institutional investors right now. That's just beginning. What's happened is that individuals, most of whom made wealth during the internet era of development, are seeing space as the next internet. They're seeing that we're moving from a metaphorical mainframe to the personal computing era. That's very similar to what we're doing in space. We're moving from the mainframe era of large government launchers and systems into those that are being put in the hands of individuals. So there's the same sort of opportunity being seen by those individuals that saw the same opportunity in the transition from mainframes to personal computers. So that's why you see Elon Musk and Jeff Bezos and Paul Allen, Elon Musk, and now Naveen Jain with Moon Express seeing this opportunity. So never before in human history has there been so much capital in the hands of a relatively few individuals who can make the decision themselves of what they do with their own. And hats off to them. But although they're all very different individuals, I think that there is a common thread that while they are inspired by large-scale vision of the benefits of opening up space to humanity and the need and necessity of becoming a multi-planet species, I believe that all of them share that vision, and they all grew up like you and I did, David, with the Apollo, you know, generation and inspired by Star Trek, and they all did this. But they also are business people believe that unless you have a sustainable economic business, it's not worthwhile doing. So it wouldn't be worthwhile throwing your wealth at something that doesn't have the right upside. So every case, and particularly in Moon Express, because I have more insight into that than the others, of course, we are held to a very high standard of building value in the company as we go along, so we have the credibility of our technical competency and our ability to carry out programs and our ability to create value for our shareholders at every step of the way. And it's the Silicon Valley, California, U.S. West Coast openness to large-scale opportunities that really is the only, I think, the only place on Earth that I've experienced that has the combination of people with the capacity to invest large sums of money with the vision of large-scale, long-term returns to humanity, but with the short-term prerequisite that it be a viable business. And that's why you see, you know, SpaceX is a poster child for this, and they're delivering great value to their investors every step of the way. and they're forging through they're the pioneers in this, and forging through a jungle, and once the first exit, meaning the first time that a large commercial private sector startup goes public, and I think that will be SpaceX, and you might see that in a couple of years, that's going to be the Netscape moment, you know, that we're all waiting for, that's going to make the job easier for the rest of us that are following in that path.
Do the investors, they're not therefore looking at a five-year exit strategy or a payback in 5 or 7 years. They're willing to go into the long run if it meets the requirements you just got through telling us about. Sustainable business, you know, game-changing for humanity, and you're changing a world going from mainframe to the PC is the metaphor that you use.
Well, I think that's true, David, when you're talking about individuals with their own wealth being directly invested into shares into a company. But when you get into more institutional funds, whether it's institutional angel rounds or it's more like VC capital, you still have to make the ratios and fit the mold of what because at that point many people and many shareholder interests are being represented, which have those shorter term ROIs, and that's why you see a cyclic buildup where you have milestone achievements that prove the ability of the company, and at every time that there's another achievement, a technical milestone, you're establishing a new value for the company, and different investors have different tolerances and interests and appetites for being in the game at any particular stage of the company development, and you still have to be aware and respectful of that if you're going to succeed in your long-term plan.
Andrew is in Seattle by email. And listeners, again, you know, I keep driving for phone calls, 1-866-687-7223. But Andrew says, do you have any business advice for someone who wants to start up a space entrepreneur company with an idea that I think will be very, very profitable? What would your startup advice be?
Well, you know, I think Elon maybe said it best when he was interviewed at TechCrunch Disrupt not long ago, and he said starting any new company is like staring into the abyss of death, because you just don't know what's going to happen. And if you're an entrepreneur, it doesn't matter whether it's space or anything else, you have to have three things. You have to have the passion and the dedication that this is going to happen no matter what. But it can't be, passion, enthusiasm without wisdom will defeat itself, is my second point. So passion and dedication and commitment, yes, but not enthusiasm for what you're doing without the wisdom of it being a good idea. So make sure it's a good idea. Do your homework. And you don't want to, you know, be pursuing something that somebody's going to shoot you down that it's been done before, or what about this? You have to really, really make sure that you have the proper advice and have done your diligence on your idea. And if not, you know, there are a million great ideas. You know, if I had a dollar for every million-dollar idea I had, I'd have $1 million. It's in the execution of those ideas that value is accreted. So the third aspect is that, you know, in addition to you have to be passionate and you also have to have wisdom on top of your enthusiasm, you have to make sure that you have credibility behind you when you propose your idea. So as an extreme example, if you've done nothing in the entrepreneurial or the business world and you come up with some great idea that's going to make some investor $1 billion, and you're immediately going to be assessed as not credible. So don't propose something that is beyond the reach of your credibility. Make sure that you have, and if you don't have those pedigrees, build them up, and bootstrap yourself to the point that you have, when you approach somebody with an idea, they make an instant assessment about you that you're above their line of credibility. Otherwise, they stop listening to you in the first 10 seconds.
You know, absolutely. So, you know, Andrew, if that means you partner with somebody who has the credibility and the experience, you know, a piece of something is worth a hell of a lot more than 100% of nothing. So, you know, there's always ways to get credibility if you're young and lacking in inexperience. So don't be shy about that. That's what I would say. What should we, who follow Google Lunar X Prize and the top teams, which includes Moon Express, what should we look for over the next year? Are there any milestones or any things that we should be on the lookout for to sort of chart and follow your progress?
Absolutely, David. This is, you know, the competition is going on these almost 4 years now. Now it's going to get interesting. Because this is the way that space works, and you can't just come out of nowhere and execute a moon mission or any type of space mission. Space missions, for a number of reasons, take a long time to execute, mostly because there are technologies that you need to buy that you can't just go on eBay and buy them. So there are many, you know, elements of your mission that take 18 to 24 months to procure, the most obvious of which is the rocket. So unless you're doing something complete stealth, or somebody is, the one of the main indicators that you should be watching is what people do, what teams do over the next year in the procurement of and their announcements of their launch capabilities, of their launch procurements. If you haven't had a rocket secured by the end of next year, it's going to be very hard to execute a Google Lunar X Prize mission by the end of 2015. If you're sitting at the end of 2013 without a rocket, you better start looking at merging, partnering with somebody who has one. So I think what you're going to see in the next year in particular is a merge and purge, consolidation and partnering between Google and XPRIZE teams. It's a very natural thing to have happen. There are, you know, three kind of categories of XPRIZE competitors in every competition that I've observed. There's a handful that have super credibility and the capacity, at least, to probably pull it off. And there is a group kind of in the middle that have very interesting ideas and hey, you know, who's to say that they couldn't pull some innovation together and some investors and make it happen? And then there's a group of there's a group that's in it for reasons other than, let's say, the main objective, which in the Google and XPRIZE case could be education and public outreach and all those amazing and great things that need to have that have to happen in the industry as well. So in many cases, and XPRIZE, and in particular Google and XPRIZE, I think you see a lot of teams that have complementarity that you may see some partnering and some merging taking place over the next year.
Would your team be partnering with anyone?
Well, that's a pretty direct question, David.
Well, you brought it up. But, you know, I'm a curious kind of guy.
Right. So, So from the business perspective, you are always, always open to business ideas that makes sense. So where if there was a partner out there that provided something of value that we currently don't have or that would displace the requirement for us to capitalize or expense it, then there's an opportunity for sponsor for partnership. So I think that goes for any business. The bottom line in the Google Lunar X Prize in any business is, are you financed? I think it's been pretty apparent if you look at Lunar Express that we are forging forward with very significant and substantial backing from Silicon Valley, and my co-founders Naveen Jain and Barney Pell have stepped up and added a completely new dimension to the Google Lunar X Prize competition that didn't exist previously. And we haven't announced all of our investors, but they are substantial. And so we are forging forward as a company. That doesn't mean that we wouldn't look at partnerships, but right now we're keeping our head down, focused on our own execution of our own business plan.
But of course, as you or any company goes further and further down the road of developing your plan and your hardware and your technology, partnering with someone who has a vastly different approach probably is ruled out just because your approaches are probably incompatible. Is that a decent assumption to make?
It is a very decent assumption to make. Exactly. And it may not be that one particular approach is wrong. It's just it's different, and they're not compatible. And you don't want to have split infinities. Also, bringing organizations together, especially ones that have been invested into developing their own plans for years, let's say, there's a lot of baggage with everybody. I guess that's a negative term for the positive aspect that you have a certain philosophy, you have personalities, there's egos involved, and M&A, merger and acquisition of companies, is always a very challenging endeavor, and that's why there's a whole sector of investment dedicated to it.
Well, and then you would have cultural issues to assimilate two teams, so that always becomes a challenge as well.
Absolutely.
Pearls of wisdom, takeaways for us today, and until the next time you're a guest on the Space Show, how would you like to leave us today?
Well, David, maybe I could just end with a point that I made in V-Lab, that this is about the expansion of the economic sphere of Earth. And, you know, that's what inspires me. I believe that it has to be a worthwhile business in order for this to work out. But throughout history, it's the explorers that have paved the way towards new opportunities. You know, the lawyers and the accountants will follow the explorers, right?
Right.
And humanity, you know, began where their economic spheres were restrained to villages, and technology allowed the expansion of economic spheres to include the entire globe of the Earth. And right now we have economic sphere expanding into space as personal spaceflight becomes a reality in low Earth orbit, as geosynchronous satellites are already a reality with billions of dollars worth of revenue flowing through geosynchronous orbit. We are invested, Lunar Express and others, into expanding the economic sphere of Earth to the Moon, another order of magnitude, which will be an ever-increasing sphere, bringing value back to Earth and helping us become the multi-planet species that I believe we're destined to and need to become.
And listeners, their website is moonexpress.com. You can check it out. There's a contact email address there if you want more information. And I look forward to talking to you again and following what Moon Express is doing. And we have other guests on as well. Tim Pickens comes on to talk about his venture. So as you say, the competition is healthy, and you know, I hope someone makes it and wins. And you know, if you have a victory party down there in the valley, invite me down. As you
will do, David.
As you crack those.
Being on the show. Bye.
Yeah, thank you very much, Bob. And listeners, that's it. Remember, we're coming back live Friday at the end of Space 2011, as I'll be in Long Beach all week. Goodbye from Bob Richards and the Space Show.